Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding, your silence is commanded.
All right, go ahead and have a seat, please. This morning, the case we are hearing is State versus Damian Von Jackson, Jr., 19 AP 2383. And before I get counsel's appearances, I would like to recognize that Central Wisconsin Christian High School is here from Waupun. Yes? Can you stand up? We'll say hi to you.
Oh, great.
Wow, good group. Really big group. Good. Well, what else are you going to do on a nice rainy day than be in court with us? So it's nice to have you here. Safe travels. And I think Justice Kurofsky may be meeting with you if you have time after the second oral argument today. So thanks for coming. Thanks for joining us. And we hope you find this case to be interesting. Go ahead and have a seat. Could I please have counsel's appearances on the Jackson matter? Good morning. Good morning. All right. The lineup is 25 minutes, 30 minutes, 5 minutes, and rebuttal, right? Okay. Let's proceed, please.
May it please the court. My name is Melinda Swartz, and I represent the defendant, appellant petitioner Damon Jackson Jr. in this case. I'm here today asking this court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision, which affirmed the circuit court decision denying his motion to withdraw his plea on the basis of ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, regarding the two components of ineffective assistance of counsel, first, there's no real dispute here that trial counsel's communications with Mr. Jackson were abysmal and constitutional. Secondly, there's more than sufficient evidence in this record establishing that Mr. Jackson was prejudiced by counsel's deficient conduct. If, however, this court concludes that additional fact-finding is necessary to resolve this case, then Mr. Jackson is asking for a remand to the circuit court for additional fact-finding and requesting to allow me as successor counsel to amend prior counsel's post-conviction motion. Now, regarding deficient performance, in this case, there is no question that trial counsel's communication with his client was abysmal and constitutionally deficient. Prior to the jury trial date, which was November 1st, 2016, he had minimal communication with his client, with Mr. Jackson, and he chose not to discuss the plea bargain until the very morning of that jury trial. Now, this discussion that took place on the morning of the jury trial was a critically important discussion in a case that involved high stakes, required his client, to make a decision in a situation that involved a homicide case with complex legal and factual concepts. This discussion involved the most critically important topics, and it was requiring Mr. Jackson to make a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent decision whether or not to have a trial or to accept the state's plea offer. There was a lot going on in this meeting, and there was an antagonistic relationship, or there was a lot of conflict, I should say, between trial counsel and Mr. Jackson prior to this discussion. Mr. Jackson had requested that trial counsel spend more time with him. He tried communicating with him through phone calls, through letters, having his family contact counsel and the public defender's office. The public defender's office had reached out to Mr. Anderson and asked him to come to see his client. Even the court at the final pretrial had requested or ordered directed Mr. Anderson to go and visit Mr. Jackson in advance of that in advance of the November 1st jury trial date. But he didn't do that. Additionally, back in September, Mr. Jackson had filed a grievance with the Office of Lawyer Regulation against Mr. Anderson for his failure to communicate and meet with him. So again,
Counsel, the state argues that this case should be dismissed as improvidently granted because of the diversion between the issues as presented in the petition for review and as briefed in your briefing. Could you address that argument, please?
Okay, so I believe that I addressed that argument in my reply brief, but I will tell you that I believe, first of all, that it is within the issues that were presented for review. Because in the petition for review, just a minute, in the issue that was presented for review, in prior counsel's petition for review, the issue that he raised was, is a defendant prejudiced when trial counsel does not communicate with the defendant in advance of a homicide trial? And he described this issue as involving, quote, when a defendant is prejudiced by trial counsel's lack of communication, and that it provided this court an opportunity to develop the prejudice prong of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And it also argued that Mr. Jackson was prejudiced when he was sentenced as a principal when he was not the principal and received a greater sentence than his co-actors who were directly responsible for the homicide. As I argued in my reply brief, I'm also asking this court, if this court were to conclude that prior counsel did not properly litigate this issue below or that it was not included in his petition for review, that this court ignore any or disregard any waiver and proceed to decide the issue. Waiver is an issue of judicial administration and not jurisdiction, and it's a discretionary decision by this court, and that this case involves questions of law that have both been briefed by both parties here, and that there are important issues for this court to decide.
What is the area of law development for this court in light of a really thorough Court of Appeals decision that went through all of the arguments, at least what were raised below?
Okay, Your Honor, I believe that what's important is raised in my brief, in my reply brief, that what's an important decision of law for this court to decide is what is the legal standard for ineffective assistance of counsel for prejudice when it involves counsel's conduct regarding not communicating a plea that lapses.
So can I ask, if I want to, the thing that's most troubling to me about this, Attorney Schwartz, is that you make the assumption that the plea lapsed, and I get how you could make that assumption from the record, but when I read the record, I see it more as there was a plea agreement. Mr. Anderson thought that was the plea agreement, filled it out as such with the party to a crime on the actual questionnaire, and it wasn't until there was a realization that the state had filed an amended information without the party to a crime aspect that things changed. So is it possible that this is more like a breach and less like a lapse? I mean, I'm struggling with the lapse part that you argued, so if you can help me with that.
Okay, so I think it could be either lapse or it could be a breach of the plea agreement, but either way, whether it's a lapse or if it's a breach of the plea agreement, that is sufficient for prejudice.
Doesn't it matter as far as the standard goes? Because if it was actually a breach, then we wouldn't, as far as the prejudice goes, if it's material, then there wouldn't need to be a showing of prejudice.
That's,
but is the problem that the record isn't quite enough here to tell us that?
Okay. I think that, okay, there's a way to approach breach of a plea agreement. If it was raised in a post-conviction motion, it could be that the state, but a violation of due process because the state violated the plea agreement by breach. And another claim that counsel was ineffective for not objecting to it.
Right.
Okay. So what I'm saying is on this record, I believe that Mr. Jackson was prejudiced in two regards, either by the a lapse of the plea agreement that was supposed to, by the email, expire on October 28th, or because he failed to object to the state's breach of the plea agreement. Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Counsel, I want to follow up on the question asked by my dear colleague and friend who shares my last name. On pages 5 and 6 of your reply brief, you talk about legal development. And again, I get to the test for prejudice in this kind of a case. You touched upon it at the bottom of 5 and the top of 6, where you said really the Frye standard for prejudice should be implemented rather than Hill's standard. Could you further, and also made reference to the Cooper standard, could you further elucidate how and why this is law developing?
Okay.
In response to the prior question, you said there was law development, and I take it it is the argument on pages 5 and 6 of your reply brief that you were referring to.
Okay. So my argument and my explanation of why it's important for this court to develop law is because in Cooper, a case where the Hill standard did apply, this court said that the Hill standard for prejudice, where a client or a defendant has to prove that but for counsel's deficient performance, they would not have entered a plea but would have gone to trial, okay, that applies in a Hill case or in a case where the deficient performance involves counsel's, what I'm trying to say is in Cooper, this court incorrectly broadened the Hill prejudice standard to apply to all plea process cases. And in Savage, this court also quoted Cooper saying that the Hill standard applied to all plea process cases. But I think what's clear from Missouri versus Frye and Lafler versus Cooper, which this case falls under for a lapsed plea agreement, that the Hill versus Lockhart standard does not apply to all plea process cases. It applies to cases such as this, where counsel's deficient conduct was prejudicial because his client then either rejected a plea offer incorrectly, or in this case where counsel's deficient conduct ended up, his client ended up missing out on a better plea offer.
Is the Frye standard the defendant must demonstrate a reasonable probability that they would have entered a plea to the earlier offer and the result would have been more favorable by either a lesser charge conviction or a shorter sentence. Is that the
standard that you are
espousing for this case?
Right.
Is that correct?
That's correct, but I'm also trying to say that I feel that if you look at the case law that in Cooper and in Savage, this court incorrectly broadened the Hill standard to apply to all plea process cases when it clearly doesn't under United States Supreme Court law.
Under Frye.
Under Frye and under Lafler versus Cooper.
So we would distinguish between the different, that this is a different type of case that this Frye standard would apply to as opposed to other types of plea deficient cases where we would still have the Hill standard.
That's correct. Okay, so returning to deficient performance, going back to this discussion that took place between Mr. Anderson and his client, this is a critically, critically important meeting. There was a lot going on. They discussed, and also, according to Mr. Anderson's testimony, at most, this discussion was less than 1.5 hours. It took 1.3 hours, and there were 2 points at which this discussion occurred. The first part of the discussion occurred in the jail in the morning, and the second part of the discussion occurred in the afternoon in a room outside the courtroom to go over the plea questionnaire.
I'm going to ask you to go back to the Frye standard and apply it to this case, because I will tell you this is where I'm struggling, and it is at looking at the result, that the result in this case would have been more favorable either by a charge conviction, which it wouldn't have been here, because if the party to a crime were, the party to a crime didn't change anything. It wasn't a lesser charge. It just was that it was a party to a crime, which we know a party to a crime means someone either directly committed the crime or they aided and abetted in the commission of a crime. What it does not mean is that someone was an innocent bystander, or that the sentence would have been shorter. I'm having a hard time looking at this record and finding that there is a reasonable probability that had he entered a plea to the charge with party to a crime, that the sentence would have been shorter, because when I look at the reasons that the judge gave him 30 years, she focused on his extensive criminal record dating back to 2003. He had repeated revocations from probation. He had repeated violations of conditions while on supervision. He was on federal court supervision at the time he committed this offense. She noted that he was 27 years old without any physical or mental disabilities, and yet he had virtually no employment history. The two co-defendants both said that he was the shooter in this case. So help me understand your argument as to the reasonable probability that the sentence somehow would have been less even if he had pled, even if the party to a crime had been attached to the charge.
Your Honor, I think it's where Mr. Jackson would have been able to credibly maintain that he was the lookout and not the shooter, because what happened on this record is that the court rejected, she outright rejected his claim that he was just a lookout, and she said that she found that he was not accepting responsibility and that he had no remorse. And it's on those grounds. And as I said, I think that there's a difference for any, and I believe that Judge Riley talked about it, that the way that a court sentences a person, it makes a difference if they're the lookout or if they're the shooter in a homicide case.
But she never says anywhere in the sentencing, because you pled, because you did not plead as party to a crime, I am finding you to be the shooter. She talks about it because of the two co-defendants said that he was the shooter. And because I think she didn't find him credible, because when the police first contacted him, he said, I have no idea what you're even talking about, right? So he wasn't telling the truth from the beginning with the police. And I understand what your argument is, but there's nothing in the record that says that. And we know that even if he had been charged with part of the crime, he could have been the shooter, right? You can directly commit the crime and be charged as party to a crime. So I just don't understand.
Okay, but he has to prove a reasonable probability that the sentence would have been different, okay? And I believe that on this record, because she rejected him, for two elements that she said that she was rejecting, that he didn't have any remorse and that he wasn't accepting any responsibility for his conduct. And so I'm saying that on this record, all he has to prove is a reasonable probability. He doesn't have to prove that, in fact, he would have received a different sentence, but the process itself would have been more fair. He would have been able to credibly argue that, and the state would have been charging him as party to a crime. So he would have been able to credibly argue that he was not the shooter, but he was a lookout, as he's maintained throughout this case.
But at sentencing, the sentencing court said you were the shooter in this case or involved in this shooting. So it seems that in the sentence that was given, the circuit court did take account of his argument that he was only involved and not actually the shooter. Do you read that statement differently?
I don't agree with that, because she said in her sentencing that she found that he was the shooter.
Is there a way
that she could have even found him as anything other than the shooter when all he's pleading to is directly second-degree reckless homicide? If there's no party to a crime, he has to be the shooter, given this scenario, right?
That's correct. Again, I'm going to return to and I guess what I want to try to explain to the court is how critically important that discussion was that Mr. Anderson was having with his client the morning of that of the plea. That it involved a discussion of defenses, it involved a discussion of charged crimes, which included felony murder as a party to a crime with an underlying predicate offense of attempted armed robbery. He also discussed the evidence. He also discussed the prospects of trial. He also discussed the plea bargain. And he also advised Mr. Jackson of whether he or not he should take the pros and cons of taking the plea bargain and proceeding into trial.
Counsel, when was the initial charge of armed robbery jettisoned, so it wasn't a factor anymore? Or was it ever jettisoned?
It was, Your Honor. I'd have to take a look back at the record. However, it was dismissed, I believe, sometime in February.
Okay, so it was actually dismissed.
It was dismissed, and the state had said that they were going to file an amended information that removed it. However, I could not find that amended information was ever included in the or ever filed. The only amended information that was filed was the amended information that was filed the morning of
the trial
that had second degree homicide and second degree and felon in possession of a firearm as a party to a crime.
Okay, good. Thank you.
All right. So, in any event, trial counsel had a duty to make sure that Mr. Jackson understood everything, and then he also had a duty to go back and forth to make sure that they discussed everything and that Mr. Jackson understood everything. The emotions were running high that day, like I said, and as we all know, that when emotions run high, there's an element of that that impacts one's ability to understand, and people are less capable of listening under pressure due to fear, stress, or adrenaline. And it's during that conversation that Mr. Anderson told Mr. Jackson, who had consistently maintained that he was not the shooter, that the plea offer was for Mr. Jackson to plead to the homicide as a party to a crime, and he reviewed the elements of the offense as a party to a crime.
And where does that come from in the record, what you just said? That what he told Mr. Jackson specifically was that he was pleading to party to a crime and that he went over those elements with him.
Okay. I believe that I'm looking at the post-conviction motion hearing transcript, which is item 78, page 30 to 31, and that's where he advised him of that. And also on pages 42 of the post-conviction hearing transcript, and also, on Mr. Jackson's testimony of the same record item 78, page 63, and page 63.
But the trial court knew that that had happened, and certainly the prosecutor knew that that had happened, and asked the judge to make sure that Mr. Jackson understood that the party to a crime was not on the information that he was pleading to. So everything, right? So yes, I agree with everything you're saying. And the judge went back. She was about to finish, and the DA said, wait, I want to make sure Mr. Jackson understands this party to a crime. So what more was she to do?
I believe that she should have determined what his understanding was by going through the elements and also asking him what was he pleading to and what was his understanding, especially since it's on there, by asking him.
But how can she go through the she can't go through the elements of party to a crime and say, normally what a judge would say is you're pleading to party to a crime. It means you either directly committed the offense, you aided and abetted the offense. What it does not mean is that you are an innocent bystander. But the party to a crime is no longer what he is pleading to. So how can she go through those elements? She can go through the elements of the reckless homicide, but she checked.
But
he said, do you want to talk to your do you understand? Do you want to talk to your attorney? Do you need more time? No, yes, I understand. No, I don't need to talk to my attorney. No, I don't need more time.
Well, what she had previously said in the colloquy was that the elements were the same when they're not. Okay, so she contributed to his misunderstanding. But the other thing is that he understood, and it's from the record, that it was the same. That it didn't matter. He could maintain that he was not the shooter, that he was the lookout, whether or not he was pleading party to a crime. And so that was his understanding. That was a misunderstanding, and that misunderstanding was created by his counsel, but the court didn't clear it up. The court didn't ask the attorney to go out and to go over it further with his client. It was almost like she was just trying to get through the plea when maybe some time should have been taken to take a pause. Especially since party to a crime and 93905 were on the guilty plea questionnaire. She should have stopped it. Things were going too fast. And remember, we have this compression of time. I mean, Mr.
What are we supposed to say? Like, what is this court supposed to say? You have to take a time out when this happens. You have to go off the record. You have to, even though the attorney and the defendant both say we're okay, regardless, you have to stop and send them out into a conference room, or if he's in custody, you have to, you know, get him into a side room on the side of the courtroom. Like, what rule is it then that you are asking us to impose here? It just doesn't seem realistic coming from the place of a trial court judge. Can she answer, Chief Justice?
Can I answer the question?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Okay. So this is what I'm saying is the court has a duty to make sure that the plea is knowing, involuntarily, and intelligently entered, right? On this record, given what Mr. Anderson said about how he was confused by the amended information, and that he had reviewed it with Mr. Jackson as party to a crime, and given that it does make a difference in this case, whether Mr. Jackson was acting as a lookout or as the shooter, that given that, yes, I do believe that the court should have taken a break. And I don't think it's a new rule. I don't think it's a new rule. It's just making sure that the court complies with its obligation to make sure that that plea is knowing, voluntarily, and intelligently entered.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
I think that, can you hear me?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Lisa Comfer on behalf of the State. Your Honors, I do want to discuss some of the procedural problems with this case, but I feel like, of course, obviously, you're very well versed in your own rules of procedure, so I'm going to try to save those comments for the end of my remarks, but I do want to just briefly address the issue of why there's really no law development that is being done by this case. The argument that opposing counsel just made was an argument for error correction, if there was an error. I still don't think on this record that we can say that there was an error. But there's no conflict between what this court said in Cooper, what was said in Hill versus Lockhart, and what was said in Missouri versus Frye. The line from Hill versus Lockhart is what this court quoted when it said that Hill applies to the plea process. Now, that was not broadening anything. It was quoting that passage directly from the United States Supreme Court. And it does generally apply to most plea process cases. The State is not contending that Frye, looks at different facts and circumstances when we're assessing prejudice, but the reason that the court reached a different result in that case is because what other courts had been doing was indeed trying to apply the Hill versus Lockhart standard to cases like Missouri versus Fry. And the court said, no, well, we really shouldn't be looking at whether somebody would have gone to trial. We should be looking at, you know, what did this go to? Would the defendant have ended up with a better result in plea lapse situation? But neither Hill nor Cooper dealt with that situation, and there's no need to do it here for two reasons. The first reason is that by virtue of being a United States Supreme Court case, Fry already applies in Wisconsin. This court's decision in Cooper cannot overrule what the United States Supreme Court said in Missouri versus Fry about how you assess prejudice when you have a situation with a lapsed plea. That's binding law in Wisconsin. It has been, and it will be until the United States Supreme Court says otherwise. And I think the second reason why there is no need to do this in this case is that we don't have a lapsed plea.
We don't have what?
We do not have a lapsed plea. And
can you elaborate on that? Because from my questioning to Attorney Swartz, if we do have one of two things, right? Like, what the heck happened?
I don't know what happened, Justice Ballot.
It's either lapsed because it changed, or, like, someone got it wrong. And I'm not putting fault on the prosecutor. I know I've been a prosecutor in a busy court. A lot is going on. And specifically in this case, everything was communicated by email. The email is really clear what the offer is. It was party to a crime that was never put on the record at the final pretrial because the state didn't have its file. That happens all the time, too. But so then you get to trial. Mr. Anderson fills this out with party to a crime, tells his client, and I fully believe that they understood it to be party to a crime, and all of a sudden it's not. So what happened?
Here's the problem. This is exactly why this case is not the avenue to address this, Justice Dallet, is because we didn't get a good enough record at that post-conviction motion hearing to figure out what did happen between that between October 17th and November 1st, because Jackson's claim in the post-conviction court was completely different than what he's raising in this court. And that illustrates why the rules of appellate procedure are so important, because if he would have put on notice that perhaps he was bringing a breach of plea claim, we might have had some information between Jackson or the prosecutor or Mr. Anderson about what exactly happened between point A and point B here.
And so the problem with all that, and you are correct, that would have been noticed, is that Mr. Jackson is at the mercy of all of these attorneys up until this point who have made decisions about how to pursue this case.
Yes,
so
Justice
talk
Ballard.
To me about manifest injustice and why this isn't a good case for that. We use it very rarely, but this is a mess, and there is a potential, a good potential, I think at least a reasonable probability, that he was the one that suffered from this inability to be able to maintain, which evidence supported. This isn't just like a guy saying, I wasn't the shooter. We've got DNA evidence, and we got fingerprints that back up what the man is saying. And whether he was or he wasn't, he didn't get a chance to argue that.
Justice Dallet, I will be happy to answer that question. But if you just give me one moment, my point about the record here is it's really, really hard to answer that question because no one ever brought a breach of plea claim. No one ever brought an ineffective assistance claim specifically on this ground until we were in this court. So that means that none of the parties nor any of the courts below ever got a chance to research and brief this issue or get any fact-finding about what actually happened. And there are still avenues for Jackson to go back and pursue that through the proper channels. He can file a 97406 motion and say my post-conviction counsel was ineffective for failing to raise this breach of plea claim, which was clearly stronger than the claims that he did reach. There is an avenue for this, this issue to be raised if it's got some merit and go through the court system in the proper fashion. But simply lobbing this against the wall once we get to the Supreme Court level and then attempting to reconstruct what might have happened and put together what better claim Jackson might have had at this stage completely does away with the entire post-conviction process, and it makes it really difficult for either the parties or the courts or anyone else when they're dealing with the... to really know what they need to do at that trial court level to avoid a reversal from the Court of Appeals or from this court. Now, that being said, I think every single one of the issues that are raised here, I don't disagree with you, Justice Dallet. Attorney Anderson did not do what he was supposed to do. I do disagree with opposing counsel that his failures rose to the level of ineffective assistance of counsel for the reasons I stated in my brief. But there's no question, the state does not dispute, that Anderson should have communicated with this guy more. Anderson was not on the ball. Certainly Mr. Jackson demonstrated that he wasn't confident that Anderson was doing what was in Jackson's best interest. But every single issue in this case fails on prejudice. There is simply no prejudice from any of these failures. And I would be happy to explain why. I think part of the reason that this claim keeps changing and that we keep talking about so many different principles here is there a lot of these claims are getting kind of crossed and the waters muddied about what we're talking about here. So I would like to try to separate those out and keep it a little clearer. So I'm going to go through them kind of individually rather than just kind of lobbing everything as one big prejudice analysis. So first I would like to talk a little bit about the lack of prejudice from Anderson's failure to meet with Jackson more as a matter of trial strategy. And I think the record from the post-conviction motion is very, very clear that, yes, Anderson did not communicate with Jackson as much as he should have. However, Anderson spent ample amount of time doing his trial preparation on his own. He got all of the discovery in the case. He spent a large amount of time going over it personally. He went through what the co-defendant's plea agreements were. He knew what his trial strategy was going to be to impeach them. All of the motion practice had been completed long before Anderson ever even got this case. So we have to remember here that Anderson was fourth trial counsel, and he didn't get on the case until almost 2 years in. Attorney Hart filed several motions on Jackson's behalf long before Anderson was even involved. That included the Miranda Goodchild motion hearing. He filed a standard motion in limine asking for witness statements and, you know, the general long list of just general motion in limine things. Those were all ruled on. By the time Anderson got this, the only thing there was left to do was familiarize himself with the case and be ready to try it if his client wanted to take it to trial. And what we have in the post-conviction motion shows that Anderson did that. He was ready. And, you know, Anderson's many years of service, of course, also weigh in favor of his being able to do that preparation without needing multiple lengthy interviews with Jackson. He didn't completely leave him alone. He met with him a couple of times. They spoke about the witnesses. They spoke about the discovery. Jackson still has not pointed to anything that he would have told Anderson to do differently with any degree of specificity. We still don't know how Anderson's failure to meet more with Jackson before this trial date would have had any effect whatsoever on what the trial strategy was, because there is none. And when we're talking about that, I think it's also important to remember, and this kind of dovetails into this argument about why Mr. Jackson can't possibly be prejudiced from this difference between pleading as a party to a crime and pleading just to the crime directly. It's important to remember here what Anderson was going to be taking to trial. Jackson was never going to trial on second-degree reckless homicide. The two charges that he was going to be taking to trial were felony murder as a party to a crime and felon in possession of a firearm as a party to a crime. And those two combined carried a combined sentencing exposure of at least 75 years imprisonment. And I think when I broke that down, and I apologize, I think my brief says 68 years. There were a lot of repeaters and multiple moving parts to how this sentencing broke down. But it was either 68 or 75 years that he could have gotten if he's convicted on those two charges. His conviction on those two charges was all but assured. He had his co-defendants testifying against him. His statements at the Miranda Goodchild hearing were coming in because the judge had already ruled that those were admissible. And in those statements, he admits to police, "I was a lookout, I wasn't the shooter." So by admitting to police that he was a lookout and having those statements come in at trial, he is liable for felony murder as a party to a crime. And that was the charge that he was going to trial on.
Counsel, let's look at this party to the crime and whether or not it made a difference. And also I want to again return to whether or not the Court of Appeals employed the Frye test. Do you agree that the Frye test should have been or was the test to be employed here in this kind of a context?
No, Justice Bradley, I don't, because I don't think that we have a lapse plea agreement, and that's crucial to getting into Frye land. Mm-hmm. I mean, the prosecutor flat out said he was holding this plea open until the morning of trial. I think if anything, we have facts in the record that could suggest that maybe there was a breached plea agreement, but we don't know what discussions were had between Anderson and the prosecutor on that morning of trial, and clearly some occurred because both of them showed up for court ready to enter that plea.
Your opposing counsel started oral argument with the following request: to remand to the circuit court for additional fact-finding and to allow amendment of the motion for post-conviction counsel. I think that request underscores the complexity, and I'm being nice using that word, the complexity of the existing record in this case. You object to remanding to the circuit court for additional fact-finding?
Obviously, I don't think it's necessary in this case. I think if this court determines that there's something else that potentially needs to take place before the circuit court, of course a remand would be appropriate. We don't have a great record here. And again, it's because this issue was not raised or briefed. I mean, we just don't have the record to make these kinds of decisions in this case.
One of the arguments embraced by Judge Riley in the dissent is, look, of course it made a difference whether or not a judge looks at this as a party to the crime as opposed to, let me call, a straight charge without party to the crime. And as I recall, the co-defendants, Henderson, and who was the other one?
Webster,
thank you. One got 10 plus 8 years. The other got a total of, I think, 20 years in and out, extended supervision. But Mr. Jackson got 30 years, 20 years initial confinement, as I recall. So certainly there's a disparate treatment one could perceive between, and both of those, of course, had party to the crime charges. It's alone Mr. Jackson that did not. And this is the point that Judge Riley makes, that it did make a difference. Can you respond to that, please?
I can, Justice Bradley, and here's the thing. When we look at the co-defendants and the sentences that they got, they were in distinctly different situations. They were not similarly situated to Jackson at all. And I think, as Justice Karofsky was mentioning, the party to a crime designation really didn't have much to do with Judge Flancher's sentencing decision. And I went through the co-defendant's prior records here, and unlike Jackson, so Henderson admitted straight up that he was involved in this incident, he was involved in the robbery, he was involved in the shooting, he helped police, he gave them the background, he told them everybody, he snitched, basically. He came completely forward with everything.
Completely forward as long as he's not the shooter, which the evidence kind of points that he is. So he came completely forward to point the finger at Mr. Jackson.
Absolutely, Justice Dallet. But here's the problem with that, though. That's not uncommon. You know that.
No.
I mean, these.
But how much credit do we give that person?
But Mr. Jackson, when he was first contacted by the police, said, "I wasn't part of this at all."
Exactly.
Right? Wasn't that his first statement?
That was his first statement. And then when we get to all these differing statements by differing people, his later statement, 45 minutes later, is finally, "Okay, yeah, I was there. I shouldn't have gotten involved. Yeah, I was there, but I was just a lookout." I mean, and then before sentencing, Jackson goes back to saying, oh, nope, I wasn't even there. I was at my girlfriend's house. That's what he tells the PSI writer. So we've got a long string of Jackson not cooperating with the police, not cooperating with the prosecution, and not taking any responsibility whatsoever.
Is that the record of the other two defendants? Because I think that Jackson has developed quite a significant record over his life. And what does that compare, or how does that compare with the record of the other two defendants?
That's exactly where I was going to go next, Justice Rogensack. Jackson had, I think, two prior felonies and a prior federal conspiracy drug conviction.
Right.
He was out on bond at the time for that when this incident occurred, and when he also picked up three charges out of Milwaukee for manufacturing and distributing cocaine.
Right.
So Jackson had a fairly large record. Henderson was no angel, but he only had, as far as I could find, one felony conviction prior to this. I would have to go back and check because there were a lot of misdemeanors and a lot of other things going on there. But Webster had nothing at all except for a couple of misdemeanors, and most of those occurred about 10 years before this. I think it was about 8 years before this crime.
But didn't Webster, I know, I'm going to assume that each of these three defendants had a difficult relationship with the truth at different times in this record. But let's see what the objective evidence is. Didn't Webster have Carter's DNA on his clothing?
Yes.
What other objective evidence is there in this
room? Oh, I don't think Webster did, Justice Bradley.
Henderson?
It was Henderson, and he admitted that he was part of the shooting incident.
It was Webster who had his fingerprints then.
There was no direct evidence against Webster at all. The only direct evidence against Webster, unless I am forgetting about something that came back with the DNA, because I don't. I thought the test results were inconclusive on the DNA, but I don't think that report's in the record, so
Henderson's,
I apologize.
Henderson's DNA did show up on.
Henderson's fingerprints, for certain, were on the gun magazine that was found at the scene, and then Carter's DNA was found on Henderson's clothing. The only thing that suggested that perhaps Webster was the other person is the eyewitness account saying that he saw someone dressed in black that was involved. And the casino video from 4 hours later showed that Webster was dressed in black, and I'm sorry, I've got too many errs running around. That Jackson, I think, was dressed in a white sweatsuit. But we also have to look at the fact that, I believe that's all of the direct evidence that could conceivably suggest that this was perhaps Webster and not Jackson, but the other thing we have to keep in mind when we're talking about prejudice and sentencing here is that Judge Flancher had been on the bench for nearly 20 years at this point. And so most of you have some circuit court experience. There have been thousands and thousands of pleas, I'm sure, taken between everyone up on this bench. Everyone knows that just because a defendant agrees to plead to something doesn't necessarily mean that he agrees to the state's version of events. And then they go to sentencing and they say exactly that. I am not guilty of this. Here was my role. This is what I did. I'm sorry that the guy died, but it wasn't me. And I know everybody thinks it was, but that's that. And that does not require the circuit court to credit that. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Jackson's counsel at sentencing got up there, and on pages 10 and 11 of that sentencing transcript, he says, with the words, he was a party to this crime. He was not the shooter. He acted as a lookout. It was a robbery gone wrong, and nobody ever planned for this to happen. And at sentencing, Judge Flancher accepted that possibility. On page 23 of that sentencing transcript, she says, I don't believe your contention that you weren't involved. I think you were either the shooter or involved in this shooting.
I know she says that, but without party to a crime, the man just pled to second-degree reckless, and his attorney, when asked if he could rely on the facts in the criminal complaint, said yes, which was Henderson pointing the finger at Jackson. And those things made it such that she should disbelieve him. He just pled guilty to being the shooter at that point. But the problem here is that that's not what he thought he was pleading guilty to, or what Mr. Anderson, frankly, thought he was pleading guilty to.
But Jackson knew full well that that's what he was pleading to, and to reverse on, and the plea colloquy makes that very clear, and to reverse on the grounds that Judge Flancher would have viewed this differently if we would have just tacked on this party to a crime designation is essentially just reversing Judge Flancher's credibility determination about Jackson. That's what that comes down to. And that there has never been any argument made that Judge Flancher's credibility determination was clearly erroneous. And that is a decision that is always left to the sentencing court to decide who's credible and who is not. And to reverse on that basis, that's bottom line, that is what this court would be doing, would be saying, Judge Flancher, I think you should have found him credible. And that is something that this court is, and all appellate courts, are always loath to do. Because she had Jackson in front of him, and this court does not. So a couple more things I would like to talk about really briefly. I know this court hasn't asked many questions, and I think the briefs pretty thoroughly covered the Lomax factors in this case and whether Judge Flancher should have allowed Anderson to withdraw. I just wanted to very briefly point out that Lomax itself makes it very, very clear that in a situation like this one, where the case has been pending for a very long time and where the defendant has repeatedly asked for new counsel at the very last second or with very vague allegations, Lomax says specifically the trial court doesn't have to make an extremely extensive inquiry in that situation because the other factors tend to outweigh the factor on whether those need to be more thoroughly explored. So I just wanted to point that out for this court because I thought that was very much on point with what our record shows in this case. And unless there are more questions about the record, I feel like what this case really comes down to is whether we've got any prejudice, as I said before, whether we've got any prejudice here. And I think on this record, no matter which of these claims we're going after, I think you just don't have prejudice. He certainly would not have gone to trial on the armed robber or the felony murder and possession of a firearm charges under this circumstance, and there's just nothing in that sentencing transcript that makes it even remotely possible that Judge Flancher would have viewed this differently if it just would have tacked on the party to a crime designation.
Plus, if he went to trial on the felony murder and felon in possession charges, he would have also had to go to trial on the other drug case. Because
yes.
that was dismissed as part of this plea deal.
And yes, and those other drug charges, those were no small charges either, Justice Karofsky. I totaled that one up, and those carried a potential 42 years of additional sentencing exposure. So by taking the plea agreement in this case, Jackson essentially took his plea, and those charges, there was a lot of good evidence in that case, too. These were controlled buys, so the cops had everything on recording. This plea took Jackson's sentencing exposure down to a grand total of 30 years when he was facing 117 in two different cases. And I think that's significant.
And that's all makes perfect sense as long as we disregard whether or not there was a breach of a plea agreement.
The problem with, I was just about to move on to why we need to talk about some of the procedural issues in this case, Justice Dallet, because we don't know how we got from point A to point B here, and it's because this claim was not raised until we got into this court. And the rules of appellate procedure, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, are there for a reason, and it's to make sure that by the time a case gets to this court, we have the facts nailed down, we have the issues narrowed down, we know what legal principle we're going to be talking about, and everyone has an idea that we've done all the background work to get it set up to make a legal determination on a law-determining question. coming to this court and changing the game and trying to recreate what might have happened on a record where no one ever addressed the issue before ends up with this court issuing advisory opinions, which I think is exactly what would happen if this court decides the Fry issue in this case. I think it's what would happen if this court decided this on a possible breach of plea grounds in this case, because we don't know if we have a breach of plea. We don't know if it was material and substantial. We haven't had briefing on any of those issues. We haven't had fact-finding on any of those issues. And that's why it's important that the issues are presented in the defendant's post-conviction motion.
So let me ask you a question. Sometimes when David Perlman wasn't in front of this court, he would talk about a platinum standard and a gold and a silver. And I'm curious as to, is your platinum that we dismiss this as improvidently granted, or is your platinum that we go through and we discuss the merits as you laid out later in your brief and as you talked about at the beginning of the argument today?
My platinum package would be to dismiss this case as improvidently granted, because I just don't think that we've got the record or the legal principles in a position in this case to make any kind of anything other than an advisory opinion in this case. I think the question of whether Anderson was deficient in his trial preparation was already thoroughly explored by Cooper, and that disposes of this. I think we quite clearly have a plea that was left open until the morning of trial, given that the prosecutor flat out said he was leaving it open until the morning of trial, and Anderson was able to enter a plea. So we're not in a Missouri versus Fry situation. The only question really left by this case is if there's a breach of plea claim, and that has never been presented to any court at any level of this entire case.
And is it your, just from what you said at the beginning of your argument, then, is it your position that if that were an issue, that Mr. Jackson could file a
974-0906. Yeah. And I think that would probably be the more appropriate course of action, Justice Karofsky, just because, you know, there are requirements that need to be met to meet that standard too. And with the party presentation rule, as the Court of Appeals discussed in footnote 23, there may have been strategic reasons why post-conviction counsel did not bring up a breach of plea claim. We don't know that. And in order for the breach of plea claim to be properly raised and actually in a position to be decided by an appellate court, we have to know whether post-conviction counsel made a strategic decision to do that, or whether it was an oversight and whether that was unreasonable. So basically, the 974-06 procedure would put us exactly in the place to determine whether that's a viable claim or not, because Jackson would both have to plead the claim and show that post-conviction counsel was ineffective for failing to bring it, and then the merits would be properly before the Court of Appeals with a full amount of fact-finding to be able to aid us in that determination. And I think that covers everything I wanted to say. So unless there are any further questions, Your Honor, I will take a seat. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Schwartz?
Your Honor, real briefly, I just want to cover a couple of
You're
points.
Going to have to
oh,
adjust
sorry.
The mic. And yeah.
Sorry. Your Honors, I just want to cover a couple of things that counsel said and also point out something in the record. So first of all, I just want to point out, to continue, you had asked me, Justice Karofsky, where in the sentencing does Judge Flancher discuss the fact that Mr. Jackson was the shooter? And so I'm going to page 23 of, this is record item number 75, and it's page 23, and it's when she is talking about the factors that the court's required to consider at sentencing. And at the top of the page, she talks about punishment, rehabilitation, protection of the community, okay? And then she goes and she discusses what the two co-defendants received. She said Mr. Webster was sentenced to 15 years in prison, bifurcated 10 in, 5 out. Mr. Henderson was sentenced to 20 years, bifurcated 20 years and 8 out. And the very next paragraph, she says, the information in this case
Mr. Jackson does place you right in the thick of this, and I fully believe on everything that I have read that you were the shooter in this case or involved in the shooting, and your lack of remorse, your lack of responsibility is telling. And then the very next part, the very next paragraph, is that she is sentencing him to 30 years, 20 years initial confinement and 20 years of extended supervision. So she did rely on the fact that he was the shooter.
Or involved in the shooting.
I understand that. However, as Justice Dallard pointed out, he pled as second-degree reckless homicide.
My problem with that argument is, and this is just where I'm just understanding it, is it feels like that's all you're relying on. You're saying that because it was party to a crime was not on the information, that's the only reason he got this 30-year sentence. And it's not. It's his lack of remorse. It's his lack of responsibility. It's the fact he was in the thick of it. It's all the things I listed out already. The fact he was on federal paper. He had all these priors. He lied to the police. So it wasn't just that reason.
But it's his culpability. His individual culpability is a very important factor in this.
And does it have to be the only reason? Is that the test?
The test for what?
The test for prejudice.
No, it doesn't. It just has to be a reason.
She's not even saying that he's more culpable. She's just saying you were in the thick of it. You were the shooter or involved in the shooting. Mr. Henderson could have been in the thick of it. He could have been involved in the shooting. Mr. Webster could have been in the thick of it. He could have been involved in the shooting. So I just am having a hard time seeing why that somehow tells us that he can't argue about what his culpability was.
But it's coming in with what he's pled to. Okay, coming in with, if he had pled to party to a crime of second-degree reckless homicide, the court would have known that the state's position was that he was party to it. Okay, so that, and all that he has to prove is a reasonable probability of a different sentence. And if he had come in with the state's position being that he was party to a crime, then he could have credibly argued that he was the shooter based on all of those things that are the evidence that's already in the record, all the things that are pointing to the fact that he was the lookout. Okay, that he could have pled that he wasn't the shooter, that he was the lookout. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm
with you.
Okay. So I think for all the things that we've said that are already in the record. Also, I am just not clear that the records of the co-defendants are in this part of the record, and that could be something that could be supplemented if this court were to decide to remand this for further proceedings and further fact-finding. And I would ask the court that I'm asking for that in lieu of a dismissal as improvidently granted, because I believe that Mr. Jackson was denied the effective assistance of counsel. His plea was not voluntary. It was not knowing. There may have been a plea breach, or at least there was a lapse of the plea agreement, and all of those things should be part of his record as far as an 80930 motion is considered, where he doesn't have the procedural bars or the procedural requirements that he has to meet in a 97406, where he has to prove that those issues were clearly stronger than the issues that he did raise, and that's what I'm asking the court to do.
But if we do that, counsel, aren't we setting a pretty dangerous precedent to allow parties to have a do-over? Because appellate counsel like yourself, when it reaches the Supreme Court, realizes there are different and better arguments. That could happen in so many cases.
Your Honor, I think that when we're dealing with the constitutional rights, all right, the constitutional rights for a criminal defendant in a case that has this kind of a record, that remanding it for him to bring all of the issues so that all of the issues that he is constitutionally, that should have been part of his constitutional protections in this case, that this case should be remanded for further proceedings, further fact-finding. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for interesting oral argument. The court is in recess until its second.